From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
I don't know about you, but I was disgusted to see the threats made against Mark McGowan over the weekend. The Premier played them down, as you'd expect, but we definitely shouldn't. Ever since he announced WA would introduce mandatory COVID vaccination for more than a million West Aussie workers, the Premier became enemy number one for the anti-vaxxer brigade. One of those people leaked his mobile number and home address online, and the anti-vaxxers jumped on it. The police were worried enough about the situation that they pulled the Premier out of a wedding on Saturday after it was revealed someone was taking photos of his family at their Rockingham home. Police also took an anti-vaxxer and gun owner into custody after he posted a YouTube video threatening to shoot the Premier. Police Commissioner Chris Dawson says the cops, ASIO and the Federal Police are all on the case, and that anyone who makes threats or attempts anything against the Premier is going to feel the full extent of the law. Now, it's important to note that anti-vaxxer sentiment is probably smaller than we think it is. Victoria has crossed the 90% first dose mark. New South Wales is nearly at 95%, so there's no reason to think WA won't also hit that level of vaccination, even though it might take a bit longer. But when it comes to the Premier's security, it only takes one idiot, and that idiot will likely have a range of other issues beyond not wanting to get the jab, whether it's substance abuse, social isolation, or mental illness, and it can be extremely difficult to predict the behaviour of a person like that. That's why the cops aren't taking any chances. We'd like to think we live in a state where things like this don't happen, and hopefully they never do. But assuming the worst is a better strategy than thinking it could never happen here. Coming up on the show, we cross to Canberra for the latest on Scott Morrison's move to net zero, plus the new laws that'll keep your kids off social media, and we'll get an update on the search for Cleo. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live.
Making news.
Joining me now is Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. Happy Monday, mate.
Happy Monday. Here we are again.
How was your weekend?
Had a wonderful weekend. Beautiful sunshine.
How good was the
weather? Bit of a swim yesterday. Yeah, it was lovely. Had a housewarming on Saturday night.
Nice.
Had a little bit too much to drink. Felt it Sunday morning. Parenting with kids and a hangover is not fun, is it?
No. Do you know, I went to Costco.
Oh, did you? What did you buy?
So I went there with not really much in mind and ended up buying a giant Esky.
Oh, did you have a membership beforehand?
Yeah, I had a membership. And it's one of those things where I think that I've got, because I think it's about $60 or something like that for a membership, and I feel like I've got the value for money for the membership in terms of how much money I've saved.
Just from the giant Esky?
Yeah, well, I think so. Like, it's probably, say, $100. On the Esky.
How much was the Esky?
$200.
If you don't mind me asking. $200. And you reckon it would normally be $300?
$300.
How big is this Esky?
Huge. It's a huge Esky.
What is it, for a particular event? Am I asking too many questions?
Yeah, no. I welcome all the questions. It's for a Halloween event coming up. So I needed something.
Are you having a party at your place?
Having a party. So, you know, so you want to come along? What are you doing?
I have a party actually on Halloween.
And so,
but thanks for the late invite. Appreciate it.
People come along and they're like, oh, you know, they bring a six-pack of beer or a bottle of wine. You need somewhere to put it. I don't have a fridge space, so that's the thinking.
Do you ever find when you have a party like that, you end up being left with all these random drinks that then just occupy your fridge for a year?
Exactly.
You're like, what's this peach and basil record league? I've never seen this before.
Oh, gosh. That's an interesting one. Now, let's go to Gosnells, and there's breaking news this morning that has certainly shocked locals and I think everybody else in Perth.
Yeah, man in his 30s has been shot dead by police. This happened about 1 o'clock this morning in Fremantle Road. The neighbours in that area have been absolutely shocked by what's gone on here. Police have told us that the officers have been injured in the incident. They were responding to calls of a disturbance in Fremantle Road. Those officers were taken to Armidale Hospital. I'm told they've since been discharged, but as you can imagine, investigations are underway now as to what happened, what went wrong. Was it justified? All of these sorts of things.
Yeah, and those locals on that street woke up to find police and forensics crawling all over the area. Yeah. It came up as a shock. A lot of them, according to reports in the West, didn't hear the shooting, and the first they knew was when they saw the police presence.
Exactly, and they're saying there were multiple shots fired when this happened, and that one of the officers fired the shot. So it wasn't both, it was one of them who fired the shots, and both of them injured. So right now, police are trying to work out what led up to this fatal shooting, and obviously putting together a case. We've seen recently, you know, where police have been under scrutiny. So once again, it's happening.
Yeah, lots of attention on that today. And now, talking about attention, there's plenty of it on Neville Power, who, for people who don't know who he is, he's the current...
That's my chopper yeah, noise.
Yeah, he's the current chairman of Perth Airport, was the former boss of Fortescue Metals Group as well, for Twiggy Forest, and now he's been busted, allegedly breaching WA's quarantine laws.
Yes, high-profile border breach we have here. So police say two men flew in a chopper from Queensland to WA this month without completing a G2G application. One of those men on board was 63-year-old Nev Power. Of course, he was most recently handpicked by the PM to lead Australia's COVID recovery. Perhaps not leading by example here. Police allege Mr. Power and a 36-year-old man flew to Queensland, then flew a private chopper back to Exmouth on October 8. The next day, they flew to Carnarvon, then to Geraldton, refuelled along the way. It's not that easy to get from Queensland to, you know, to Jandakot, where they eventually ended up in a chopper. So Mr. Power and his travelling companion will face court, each of them facing three charges of failing to comply with a direction. They have both tested negative. They're now in self-quarantine.
Yeah, right. It's going to be fascinating to see where this goes. It's a very different situation to those Melbourne Demons footy fans
yes.
who came over, who had, you know, sort of forged driver's licenses and things like this. We're not talking about that sort of a situation, but certainly how the rules are applied to the top end of town.
Yeah,
we'll see.
This is a reality. Even if you don't get on a, you know, a domestic run-of-the-mill mainstream flight and you've got a private chopper, you still have to apply for a G2G pass.
Yep, absolutely. And now let's talk vax figures. What do you got for us?
Well, we have more than 1,245,000 fully vaccinated. Total percentage of 12 and over is sitting at 57.1% at the moment. So we need to boost that jab rate. We have got, I've seen they've converted a booze bus into a maxi-vaxi. So this bus...
What?
Well, it's like, I was calling it jab bus. Other people called it a maxi-vaxi, like maxi-taxi,
maxi-vaxi,
like vaccination.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, get it.
Boom, Tish. So it's going to be going around the state, has the ability to inject hundreds of people a day. It's not like there's needles coming out of the bus and it's just like, light them up, dop.
Like a Bond's car, yes. He presses a button and out comes that.
Out comes the Pfizer. So this is going to be driving around the state. There's pop-up clinics, one opening up in Carramar today, another one planned for Mandurah and various areas. So,
is it going to be like a Mr. Whippy van with playing the green sleeves? Hang on, here comes the maxi-vaxi.
Here comes the maxi-vaxi.
But you know what? It's going to be exactly like a Mr. Whippy, this thing, this maxi-vaxi, because it'll come around to your town, you get a vax, and then it'll go, and just like Mr. Whippy, you won't see it again for months. And so then how are you supposed to get your second jab?
Well, that's a good point. Well, they're going to have almost a bus route, aren't they, to go back around.
Exactly. They'll have to do that.
Well, unless they're thinking, you know, first jab, get people in, and then they'll seek out the second one.
Yeah, the first jab is the deepest. It's like once you get that one,
yeah, you're fine. You've passed the threshold.
Well, you know what? Like New South Wales is nearly at 95% first dose.
I know.
Crazy.
They're just firing. And even Melbourne now, restrictions being relaxed, they're looking at really fast-tracking their vaccination rate so that they get more and more freedoms. And, I mean, the federal government's got a new ad based around freedoms and it doesn't kind of work in WA because we've been rather free for almost the whole pandemic.
Well, the WA-based ad doesn't work either.
No.
So we're still to see an effective vaccination ad here for us West Aussies.
Maybe that's up for one of the creative agencies to come up with something and put it up online.
Yeah, yeah. Or just turn it over to the Fizz Twins. Give us the few hundred grand. We'll solve it.
We'll come up with something.
Yeah, all right. Let's put our heads together.
Right on.
Maddie, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Will do. Have a good one, mate.
You're listening to The West Live.
PM Scott Morrison is going to Glasgow and he wants to take a shiny new net zero emissions policy with him. Joining me now to discuss this and what should be a massive week in politics is the West Australian's federal politics editor, Lani Scar. Good morning, Lani.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You know, here in Parliament House, which is the epicentre of net zero emissions blowing up at the moment, but it's, you know, it's good.
Okay, well, now let's talk net zero. We spoke about this last week, you and I, and we were in a bit of a holding pattern to see what the Nationals and Barnaby Joyce were going to say on the net zero emissions target. So what happened yesterday?
So the Nationals had their long-awaited party room yesterday afternoon. They decided to give in-principle support to net zero emissions by 2050. You know, somewhat reluctantly for many of them, including the leader of the Nationals himself, Barnaby Joyce, who, you know, did say he is going to get behind it when he was on radio this morning, but he's not really happy about it. So we're still yet to see this morning the details of what the Prime Minister has agreed to from the big long list asks that the Nationals put to him in order to secure their support. But it's you know, it's kind of a strange feeling at the moment. The Nationals right now are in their party room meeting again this morning. They obviously gave their commitment and decision yesterday afternoon, but they're meeting again this morning. So look, it's you know, it's, I think it's a good outcome. It's what we wrote last week, that the Prime Minister was going to go to Glasgow with a net zero by 2050 commitment, but he wanted to avoid the tricky political optics of having the Nationals not agree to it. It wouldn't have been good going on the world stage with the Prime Minister's junior coalition partner not signing up to net zero emissions by 2050, and that would have been, I guess, some awkward explaining to Boris Johnson and Joe Biden about, is his government actually behind net zero emissions by 2050?
Well, I think the devil will certainly be in the details when it comes to this deal that was done between the Liberals and Nationals to get this agreement. Do you think, you know, you say that the Nationals probably don't love the idea of net zero emissions. Do you think they believe in this policy, or have they just read the tea leaves here and realised that, you know, you got to get on board this because that's what the electorate by and large wants?
I think there's no doubt that some people within the Nationals are not behind it and will never be behind it. Those people are Matt Canavan, George Christensen, and they will continue to probably make trouble or certainly make known their opposition to this in the Parliament. There is some concern about how far they might continue to go and whether they will pare back some of the behaviour we've seen over the past week. But yeah, certainly some of them will never be behind it. But they've realised, as you said, that they have to read the tea leaves and that the majority of people are moving towards this. So if they can get some things out of it on the way through, then, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
And then let's talk about your exclusive on the front page of The West today around children on social media. Can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, so the government today has put out an exposure draft legislation to basically put some more safeguards and strengthen the Privacy Act. Now, I have long followed this issue of younger people on social media and the dangers that they get into when they're on social media. You know, they can be vulnerable to predators online. So the government is basically going to put some more safeguards in place for social media companies to ensure that if a young person is on a social media site under the age of 16, they've got the consent of their parents. And if they don't, if the social media companies don't have processes to actually ensure that people are the age that they say they are online, then they could face fines of up to $10 million. So it's a real step in the right direction. There are some other privacy safeguards around the sharing of people's information and targeting in relation to marketing online that are also in this exposure draft. But I think for many parents and many, you know, grandparents, many of our listeners, this idea that the online sphere and social media could be a safer place for kids, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got the West Australian's federal politics editor, Lani Scar, on the case, keeping us up to date on all of these things in Canberra. Thanks, Lani, for joining us on the West Live. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
Now, as we just mentioned, the federal government is set to introduce tough new laws aimed at keeping Australian kids off social media platforms. To discuss the risk to young people is leading cyber safety expert and founder of YSafe, psychologist Jordan Foster. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Very well, thanks. It's great to have you back on the show. Can you tell us, why are these new laws important?
These new laws are long overdue, and I'm sure parents are so happy to hear the news this morning. It's really important. The reason that these laws are so important is because even though we see social media platforms and gaming platforms have minimum standards of sign-up, so you have to be at least 13 or some platforms is 16, there has been no age verification process on most of the major players. And even still, if there is a parental consent required, it's just a tick box that says, I've asked my parents. There's been no way of enforcing age restrictions. And because of that, what we have been seeing is primary age children accessing social media platforms at alarming rates. So this is really essential.
Mm. And so what are the main dangers for these young people accessing these sites?
It's really largely both the content that's on these platforms and also the people that kids can interact with. So social media platforms do have community guidelines of the type of content they allow, and they actually will block or take down. But in my experience, these community guidelines are very ambiguous. And not only that, but content still gets posted up, and then it will get removed once it's been reported. So unfortunately for these platforms, there is a lot of violent content, pornographic content, very inappropriate content for young consumers. And not only that, but the actual people who can contact young children on these platforms. So the mechanisms that are in place to minimise contact by strangers are not particularly robust, which means it's been really common on Instagram, for example, over the past year, for random strangers to actually send direct messages to kids and teenagers that are of pictures of them, presumably, but it's completely nude, with no context, no message prior, but just these pictures. So Instagram have in place now a way to stop that from happening. But it's been really unfortunate, the number of people who are on these platforms trying to exploit children.
Mm. And we think of Instagram and we think that, you know, generally they have those kind of content protocols in place. As you say, there can be a bit of a lag, though, before posts are reported and then dealt with. TikTok, on the other hand, which is massive with younger kids, as we know, some of the content on that is, I guess, much more sexually explicit. Do you think parents underestimate or maybe are not fully aware of the sort of things that they're seeing on TikTok?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think parents are really, they only know what they know, which is understandable, but I think they do underestimate how devastating some of the content can be on these platforms and just what's included. So, for example, with TikTok, what's really interesting is the way that TikTok works. And so, much like all social media platforms, but TikTok certainly do it the best, is they have an algorithm which assesses what they think the child wants to see. And it's based on their demographics, but it's also based on their behaviours online and what their other friends are doing. Now, what this means then is, let's just say there's a video that pops up on a child's For You page on TikTok, and kids, it's perhaps a little bit explicit or risque, but kids will watch it because they don't understand it. And they go, oh, interesting. But then TikTok thinks, well, you want to see more of this type of content. So then TikTok continues to show them not only that type of content, but content that can be even more problematic. And there is a big, trend on TikTok in particular for people promoting platforms like OnlyFans, which is a subscription-based platform that's about selling pictures of yourself to strangers who want to pay money for it. Sex workers, for example, who are promoting their services online, and you're allowed to do that on TikTok, and talking about their different customers and bits and pieces. So kids find themselves exposed to this content. And what concerns me as a psychologist is not just being exposed to it, but how it's normalized and actually glorified on these platforms when kids don't actually know what it is. And all of a sudden they're going, oh, this looks great. People are getting money. People are really happy. And so these messages are really skewed. And so if they're getting exposed to these without conversations with parents and parents don't know about it, then they're getting presented this world that actually seems really amazing, but we know as adults it's extremely problematic.
Now, if passed, these proposed new laws will see penalties for the social media companies increased from around about $2 million to $10 million. Is that the sort of big stick approach that's been needed, or do you think that's even going to move the needle for some of these mega companies?
Look, I don't think that the financial aspect of it is significant for these platforms, but what I do think is the exposure by media being called out. What we've seen with Facebook and Instagram over the past few years is anything that's been considered illegal or unethical by these platforms has been put under public scrutiny. And that's what influences their bottom line, is their consumer behaviour. So I actually think fine itself is not substantial, but the media attention and the public outcry that's paired with that, I think that's what creates change. So I do think this is a big step in the right direction.
And how confident are you that it's even possible for these companies to take all these reasonable steps to verify their users' age in a way that will create a meaningful change?
It's an interesting question, Ben, because I think from my experience, these platforms have the technology in order to actually create really strong change. They have the ability to have really robust mechanisms for age verification, for example. Where I think there's a problem is the ambiguous term of all reasonable steps, because that enforcing that means that you have to have an understanding about what technology is actually capable of and what can be done on these platforms. And I think they're very good historically at suggesting that they've taken reasonable steps, but perhaps we know that they could do better. And so I think until there's really strict parameters about what does reasonable steps actually mean and what does it look like and how are they held accountable to that, I think that these platforms will continuously fall short on enforcing what that is, what's a reasonable step.
Well, we've mentioned a couple of things today already when it comes to this issue. That's the sort of content that kids are exposed to and maybe the sorts of people that kids are exposed to on these platforms. But there's another major concern when it comes to the Australian Federal Police. They're worried that kids as young as 13 might be increasingly becoming radicalised online. Why is this something that occurs on social media?
Social media does attract lots of different types of young users, and we know that the people that are targeting young children in terms of promoting these radicalised messages are targeting kids who are otherwise vulnerable or socially isolated. So young people are going through a phase of identity formation, trying to figure out who am I and where do I fit. And if you pair that developmental milestone with typically social exclusion online, that creates a very vulnerable child who is very impressionable. And if you have that with a little bit of angst, you've got this recipe of a child who can be very easily influenced in terms of their ideology, in terms of what they want to do, joining a mission and things like that. So we are seeing kids, unfortunately, getting roped into these types of groups and these types of messages and then behaving in a way that's individual violence against people, organisations or groups of other people. So young people in that way are a bit of a ticking time bomb when they're vulnerable, being targeted by these groups and these people.
And the feds think it's gotten worse during the pandemic, with kids being at home and online more than usual, especially in the East Coast where they've had a lot of lockdowns. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, we've actually been seeing that globally. And I think that what we can pair that with, a lot of young people feeling very alone and very angry and not actually having much control over their own environment. So this joining these groups or pushing this ideology actually gives them a sense of control over their own being and having a sense of purpose. I'm not necessarily saying it's a good one, obviously, but it gives them something back. And when COVID has been so tumultuous and there's been a lot of young people at home not being able to take care of themselves or their own well-being, it's an unfortunate outlet for many young people.
And now I know YSAFE, your organisation, is working on a paper at the moment that you're going to submit to government around parental controls on devices, which ties into what we've been talking about today. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The government, and rightly so, has been focusing a lot on social media platforms, and that is absolutely essential. But what we have noticed is that the operating systems are not getting as much exposure. And operating systems are things like Apple, Google, Microsoft. And from a parent perspective, what this means, and this comes up when I talk to parents all the time, is they say to me, I've just put screen time settings on my child's Apple device or their iPad, or I've put on Family Link for my Android device, but my child just turned 13 and all of a sudden they're not working. Now, if you read the T's and C's for Apple and Google in particular, they actually clearly state that once a child turns 13, they have the right to opt out of their parents' safety settings. And parents actually have to ask permission for their 13-year-old to join back. It's outrageous that operating systems are actually giving more power to teenagers than they are to their parents. And they've actually, unfortunately, over the past few years, had a monopoly on parental control tools. So they're trying to, from what it seems, push people into using the built-in control settings and not using third-party apps that actually have far more effective, I suggest, and robust settings. So parents are really behind the eight ball and they don't even know it, which is shocking.
Well, it certainly is shocking that big tech is making a decision on when your 13-year-old is old enough to make decisions for themselves. My goodness, that's exactly. Pretty scary. YSAFE founder Jordan Foster, thanks as always for being on the show. We really appreciate your insights. Thanks for being on The West Live.
Thanks, Ben.
Now, revelations Mark McGowan had suffered a second security breach in the past 6 months at his home in Rockingham have raised some serious concerns about the safety of the state premier. Threats are nothing new for politicians, but are the stakes getting higher? Joining me now to unpack the issue is national security expert, Curtin University, Alexei Muravyov. Good morning, Alexei.
Good morning, man.
And so, do you expect security protocol will need to be increased for political leaders in the future?
Look, I think security protocols will have to be enforced. I'm not really sure about increasing them or not, but obviously we need to understand that currently we live in the state of undeclared civil emergency. You know, COVID-19 has turned WA into fortress state, and in this sense, the effective management, the effective leadership is really critical as well as pivotal to the well-being of our economy, to well-being of our people. So we need to ensure that our politicians and certainly our key decision makers, such as the premier, have to be protected so they don't have to be worried or their day-to-day activities will not be disrupted by any unforeseen circumstances, including invasions into their personal space, let alone threats to their health, well-being or their life.
Well, the premier's personal mobile number and address were leaked online and spread on social media. How much of that is, I guess, a statement of the times that we live in? And, you know, what comes as the cost for trying to be accessible to the people, but then maybe a little bit too accessible?
Look, I mean, I think anyone who would have violations into their private space would feel incredibly uncomfortable about this. But here we have a situation when a prominent figure whose well-being is really pivotal to the well-being of the state, and this is not an overstatement, he needs to be accessible to the people, but there should also be reasonable expectations about privacy, about space, as we all do. So and I think it's certainly part of this dirty politics and clearly dirty games that certain elements in the society are trying to play in order to achieve their agendas. You can have a debate about the effectiveness of the vaccine and whether vaccination should be mandatory or should be voluntary, whether state borders should remain closed or should be lifted. But it needs to be undertaken in a civilized manner within the legal parameters. You know, using dirty tricks like putting effectively a form of blackmail on a strategic decision maker such as the premier is simply unacceptable. And obviously, this behavior needs to be confronted. And these tactics have to be challenged through legal means, by means of law enforcement countermeasures, because it opens up the Pandora box. You know, today you're targeting the premier, tomorrow you may be targeting anyone else. And if our premier feels vulnerable, what can we say about the state of personal safety and security of ordinary citizens who are not subject to special security protocols?
And now, in the wake of this incident over the weekend, the Premier was asked to comment on his security. He said that he wasn't going to talk about his personal security. How much of that is just a standard protocol so you don't reveal too much information that could be used against you?
You're not supposed to reveal any information, because obviously if you start discussing this is how my security entourage carries out his or her duties, they effectively give away clues to those who may have instigating some plots against you or anyone. So security needs to be undertaken in a way that it's stealthy, but it's also surprising to effectively the bad elements. So, I mean, it would be foolish or incredibly inexperienced for him to reveal the extent of his security protocols and how it's going to be done, etc. So I think his answer was absolutely appropriate.
And now we've seen that terrible incident in the UK with an MP who was killed in public a couple of weeks ago. We know Australian MPs are concerned about this as well. Do you think this kind of security threat, whether it's just a lone actor or something more politically motivated, could be a big problem here in Australia?
Look, I think we need to understand and put things in the context. There are obviously many frustrating people given the circumstances under which we're living in. There is a degree of tiredness, there is a degree of fatigue, and certainly we have been incredibly lucky in Western Australia compared to other states across Australia. But being frustrated and experiencing this fatigue or not being able to live your normal life, not being able to travel, not being able to connect to people should not still offer any excuses for unruly, live alone, illegal or life-threatening behavior. And yes, there's been a greater problem, I think, in across the Western society, you know, because we've certainly been thinking and cherishing our personal freedoms, etc. But again, I think everything needs to be kept in balance, and person's personal freedoms should not come to at the expense of you invading somebody else's space because you just feel you want to express yourself. The freedom of expression, the freedom of free speech should not be treated and exploited in ways that it would put other people in really uncomfortable, live alone, life-threatening situations. So we still have to have established red lines, which are effectively pivotal for us retaining law and order, agreed and established rules of engagement when it comes to interactions, including discussions of uncomfortable and sensitive matters such as our responses to COVID, our discussion of our freedoms and civil liberties in times, as I have noted earlier, of undeclared civil emergency. We have to understand, and the community needs to understand, the exceptional circumstances in which we find ourselves in. So pretending that somehow it can be balanced whilst not compromising on other things is we would kid ourselves about that. And certainly we should not really release our frustrations at the politician who is apparently doing a fine job. And I'm not saying this because I want to act like an apologist for Premier McGowan, but simply because people voted for him and people's approval continue to remain at an astonishingly high rate in terms of how people regard his performance and how they measure his activities. And that also needs to be taken into account. We have to listen not just to the minority, but also to the majority.
Yeah, absolutely. Alexei Muravyov, National Security Expert at Curtin University, thanks for your time on The West Live this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's been just over a week since 4-year-old Cleo Smith vanished from her family's tent in Carnarvon. And after a large-scale land and sea search and the launch of a task force, police may now have an important break in the case. Joining me now is investigative journalist Kristen Shorten. Good morning, Kristen.
Hey, Ben. How are you going?
Good, thank you. Now, we've spoken about this last week. You've been following the case very closely. What is this new break in the investigation?
Well, yesterday, the Major Crime Squad revealed that two witnesses had come forward very recently and provided detectives with information that they had actually seen a vehicle, described as a passenger vehicle rather than a truck, turn right or south off Blowholes Road Drive onto the highway headed towards Carnarvon at about 3 a.m. on the morning that Cleo Smith vanished.
Mm. And so it's not hard to see why police would be keen to speak to the people in that car. Have they revealed anything as to why they consider it significant?
Well, police are really, tempering their excitement or treating it as a piece of information that they need to thoroughly explore, you know, investigate and get to the bottom of, but without, expressing or pinning too much, you know, hope or excitement on that lead. So, they've said that it is an important piece of information, and it obviously is, given that they've now released it to the media and the public and are appealing for assistance with it. But they are also saying that, you know, there could be an innocent explanation. Blowholes Road, it does service a long stretch of coast in that Quabba Point region, and there are other turnoffs on Blowholes Road to other campsites or camping areas, in addition to the one where Cleo and her family were staying. So police are saying, look, the people in this vehicle could have been driving along for a completely innocent purpose, or they themselves could be witnesses, but they do want to find whoever was in that vehicle, whether that be one or two people or more, because that's another part that they're not sure of. They do want to talk to them, find out what they were doing, where they were going, and why they were travelling around in the dark at 3 a.m. on that morning.
Mm. Well, police put a statewide call for information out last week, and they've labelled the witnesses who came forward who saw this car as credible. What can you tell us about the other reports that they've had in from the public?
Well, I know that they've had hundreds and hundreds of calls to Crime Stoppers, but the public doesn't have any, sense of what those calls have been. I mean, police haven't revealed any details of what those Crime Stopper calls, the nature of them or what information they've included. So, I assume just from covering previous child abductions that, perhaps a lot of them are about possible sightings and things like that. But police have told me that they have not received reports of any credible sightings from interstate authorities or agencies or members of the public. So they do still believe that Cleo, if she was abducted, would be within Western Australia. And, there's no credible sightings or reports that she has been taken across the border, but we don't know a lot about the calls relating to information within WA.
Mm. And now the sighting of this car is interesting because police have also revealed that their investigation into whether someone was stalking Cleo hit a dead end.
Look, police have told me yesterday in no uncertain terms that Cleo was not being stalked. There's no evidence or information at all to support that theory. They're not sure where that came from, but they certainly want to quash that, line of speculation. They've said that they have no reason to believe Cleo was being stalked. And I think that, resulted from reporters and the media seeing forensic officers at the home of Cleo's family in South Carnarvon. They were carrying out forensic examinations of the perimeter and outside of the home. Now, that's very standard practice for an investigation such as this where there is a missing person, and that's just part of police being thorough in their investigation and covering off all bases. It certainly isn't an indication that there was a stalker, but, of course, they would be interested to see if there were any signs of trespass or anything like that at the property, but the stalker theory is one that they've said has no substance.
Mm. And so where does the investigation go now?
Well, now police will be, I don't know, frantic's the right word, but, you know, very methodically combing through all of the footage that we have, all of the footage that they have, that they've obtained, whether that be dash cam footage, CCTV footage, you know, that could corroborate this vehicle sighting, that this 3 a.m. vehicle sighting turning off Blow Holes Road. So they will now, they said yesterday that they hadn't been at that stage able to find any other footage or corroborating evidence of this vehicle, but I'd say that a lot of their effort now would be focused on finding anything else that could help them identify this particular vehicle, whether that be from, you know, it was headed south, they assuming that it might have then gone to Carnarvon. So they'll be obviously seeking footage from within the Carnarvon township as well as possibly further south and, yeah, just really trying to pin down where this vehicle was going.
Mm. And Detective Superintendent Rod Wild, who's leading the investigation, said he's still hopeful Cleo will be found alive. From your experience with missing children cases, do you think it's important he puts this forward to the public?
His hope that she will be found alive?
Yes.
Yeah, look, experts in child abduction cases have, you know, come out and said that in most cases, very, you know, sadly and unfortunately, the reality is that a child would be killed quite quickly after the abduction. That's, you know, such a horrible prospect that I hate being, you know, I hate even kind of floating that scenario, but, you know, keeping a child alive and looking after them is very, you know, involves a lot of work. You've got to keep them fed, bathed,
hidden,
help them go to the toilet, hidden, quiet. You know, anyone with small children knows that that's almost impossible. So, look, I, you know, I also would like to reiterate Superintendent Wild's sentiments that we all hope that Cleo is found alive, and I definitely don't want to put out there that she might not be alive, but, you know, I think if you go off what experts have said in previous child abduction cases, usually, unfortunately, you know, yeah.
The odds are stacked against it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a terribly tough situation and one that is still unfolding before our eyes. Investigative journalist Kristen Shorten, thanks for joining us again on The West Live.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ben. Speak soon.
The desperate search for Cleo, her parents and police need your help. Join the search for answers. Live from the head of the task force and the crime scene in Carnarvon. Flashpoint, 9:05 on 7. The Wild West.
Joining me now in the studio is The West Online's Kate Phillips. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. How are you going?
Good. Well, before we get into the fun of the Wild West, let's just touch on some more Cleo news. We see on Perth Now this morning, Margaret Dodd has offered support to the family.
Yeah, that's right. So she's come out and spoken, I guess, about how she's obviously been through a similar experience, and her heart goes out to them, and she's asked for them to hold on to hope, essentially, that, you know, what's, I think, made her feel better about it is they've gotten onto this very quickly, whereas maybe it was a little bit sluggish in her case with Hayley. And she said, look, you know, you don't know yet, and just keep that hope up.
Yeah, I think that's all you can really do. And, you know, I think that sentiment comes from somebody who has been in Ellie Smith's shoes, knows what it's like. So certainly I think some words there for Ellie Smith to hang on to, I guess.
Yeah.
In a pretty tough time.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
A tough time for Friends fans as well.
Yes.
A fan favourite.
That's right.
Has unfortunately passed away.
He has. So he's known as Gunter. Is it Gunter? I'm not
Gunter?
Sure. Yeah, it's Gunter. That's how I'd say it. We've had a bit of a debate in the office. He's passed away from cancer. So he's actually been battling it for 3 years. And he's gone peacefully at home, and apparently just got worse during COVID, unfortunately. And, so he's passed away around with family and friends around him after a very long battle. So
yeah,
it's very sad.
James Michael Tyler. He was 59 years old.
Yes, he was young.
He was young. Did we see him in the Friends special, the reunion special?
Yeah, in the reunion. Yeah, he made a bit of a guest appearance, but it was via video link because of because of COVID. And he has, you know, he sort of came out and spoke about his battle with cancer, his prostate cancer, previously, just saying that, you know, it had been a struggle, but he sort of thought he was turning a corner. But yeah, no.
Yeah, sad news for Friends fans. But everyone can was still watching Friends like crazy. Is it on Netflix, I think, these days?
Yeah.
So no doubt you can watch an episode for Gunther tonight. Now, talking about bad news in the entertainment industry, this story was really shocking. This tragic death on a film set of which Alec Baldwin was the main star.
Yeah, truly awful and like something from a movie, you know, like you wouldn't expect it. So obviously he was holding a prop gun and it was actually loaded and it's been fired at one of the people on set, a woman, and she's sadly been killed.
Yeah, the cinematographer on the
set. Yeah, that's right, the cinematographer.
Was killed and everybody was in shock. Interesting reporting that has come out since then. Mm. Talk of some members of the crew had actually walked off set in the days before that over concerns about gun safety on this production. And the film was called Rust. It's a very low-budget film. Mm-hmm. And there's now this broader debate around I guess the safety protocols on these low-budget films, which are probably not to the same level as they are on a big studio production.
No, that's right. They wouldn't be anywhere near the level of a Hollywood film or that sort of thing. And I guess, you know, he's obviously taking the gun, expecting it to be a prop gun. Mm. But, yeah, so there's obviously been a lot of upset people, a lot of people
pretty
worried
tough.
About
imagine
the safety.
Being Alec Baldwin.
Yeah. Well, he was inconsolable. Apparently he cried. He was hysterical for hours afterwards. And he's actually... I reined that in a little bit and gone to see the family of the cinematographer that was killed and spent time with her husband and her child and, you know, given them a lot of time and just tried to console them and, I guess, heal himself a little bit. So,
if you're an actor in Hollywood, you'd really be thinking twice next time you were called onto a set and asked to shoot a prop gun, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, God, I don't even know how it happens, right? Yeah. You know, you'd want to check every single prop and make sure, we'll just keep them unloaded until the day, you know, I just don't.
And there was a 911 call now that's been released?
Yeah, so they've released some details from the 911 call and obviously everyone was really panicked. One of the crew members actually made the call and apparently you can hear that, you know, there's a lot of commotion in the background, but he's sort of tried to blame it on another set member. This is apparently what's been said. Yeah, sorry, crew member, someone on set. But I think maybe it was confusion as to what had actually happened.
What happened.
Pure panic.
We'll have to wait and see because there's going to be more reported on this topic for sure.
Yeah.
And now, meanwhile, Ed Sheeran, he's got the Rona.
Yeah, he's got COVID. Ed Sheeran, of all people. We thought he was, you know, untouchable, but yeah, unfortunately. So that means he's had to cancel his tour. He won't be able to travel to the US to be on Saturday Night Live. So it's really put a bit of a spanner in the works.
Oh, wow, terrible timing.
Yeah, so he hasn't really said, you know, he hasn't updated on his condition necessarily. He's just said
so he's not vaccinated.
I don't know, actually. He didn't talk about whether or not he was vaccinated. And he didn't really say that he was super sick. He just said he was isolating. And
well, because it is possible, right? Like, it is possible to be double vaxxed and still catch the Delta or something like that.
It's just meant to be a much... Yeah, it impacts you less, apparently, you know, and then you're less likely to spread it because it's that lower dose.
So I don't know. I wonder if we can find out whether he was vaxxed or not, because it'd be a real... let's see, let's have a quick look. No, don't know. We'll see if we can come back to that one.
We would expect so, because he obviously has to do a lot of travel and that sort of thing.
And you wouldn't be able to get into some countries unless you were double vaxxed. You have to think that he was. And playing some of the stadiums in some US states, you have to be vaccinated to even walk in to those venues.
Exactly right.
And now, Married at First Sight stars... Mm. Bryce and Melissa have revealed their boys' sweet and very unique names.
That's right. So, you know, it's been big news that they have their twins and they've just let everybody know that they've named them Levi and Tate.
Are they unique?
Oh, I don't know. I was thinking the same thing. No, not
there's
really. Certainly not Levi. Yeah, yeah.
Tate.
It's a little more unique.
I don't know. That's an interesting one. I don't think that's very out of the ordinary.
No, nor do I, but I think the whole...
I was expecting something really wacky.
I know. Well, especially from those two, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's the meaning. They were saying that Levi means harmony among others and Tate means cheerful. So I think that was a sort of, you know, sweet reference. But unique, I'm with you. I'm not sold.
Yeah. No, I think they could have pushed the button. My expectation with celebrities is if you're going to come up with a wild name, you got to push the boat out.
Yeah, symbols need to be in there somewhere.
Just
you know,
an emoji,
some sort of
like
noise.
The new Coldplay album where half the songs are emojis. Like, what the heck is going on there?
Oh yeah, an emoji would have been perfect, actually. Yeah.
And so, for people who don't know, so what was the deal with Bryce and Melissa on Married at First Sight?
So they were a very controversial couple. So he was basically accused of gaslighting her and just sort of trapping her into this sort of, you know, what some would say abusive relationship. And people kept trying to split them up and catch him out, but she stayed with him. And,
sadly, they're the ones that lasted. They had twins?
That's right.
Yeah, right. Wow.
So they lasted the distance.
Just goes to show, doesn't it?
I know. I don't know if it's healthy necessarily.
Talking about healthy, this next story I'm pretty sure is definitely not healthy. So Manchester United legend Paul Scholes has been captured on an Instagram video with a kind of like an unusual technique for keeping his daughter's toenails trimmed.
Yeah, look, it's really interesting personal hygiene sort of habits here. But yeah, so it hasn't been proven necessarily that it is his daughter, but he is, I'm pretty sure it is, it's on her account, but he's been posted holding her foot, and it looks as though he's gnawing on her toenails in order to, you know, yeah.
To trim them.
To trim them. And she's posted on, you know, on this little post saying true love.
It's a lot worse if it's not his daughter.
I know. Well, I don't know. Is it? What? I think it's pretty bad either way. I think it's just so disgusting.
Daughter?
She's 20. So.
Oh, what? I thought we were talking about like a five-year-old.
She's 20 years old.
Well, maybe it's not his daughter then.
She's very well known. You know, she's a bit of a socialite. And I think she got in trouble for holding a party during, you know, the COVID lockdown and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So she's a bit controversial too. So
now I think it is actually more weird that it is his daughter.
Yeah, me too.
I changed my mind on that.
Yeah, she's a beautiful-looking woman.
That makes me want to vomit.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. Like, whoever's
20-year-old.
But imagine chewing someone's toenail off. Like, just that
like
on
a
its
little
own.
Kid. Like, if it was like a 3-year-old kid, maybe I could justify
No, I don't know. And especially with, you know, 3-year-old kids not wearing shoes running around, I just think you deserve
gross.
To get
yeah,
some sort of virus.
Just, exactly. You catch something worse than what Ed Sheeran's got.
Yeah.
Well, Kate Phillips, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today with these very strange, disparate bunch of stories. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Speak to you then.
Well, that's it from me. Good to have your company. We'll be back tomorrow live from 8:45 a.m. You can download the full show or individual interviews by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on the west.com.au to deliver.